I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. The way out of pain is through it. That philosophy is at the core of the work of practicing New York psychiatrist Dr. Mark Epstein. Dr. Epstein has worked with countless clients who struggle, as we all do, with the trauma of everyday life. Some of it is unfathomable, too painful to look at, and some, the little things, we also turn from and keep on moving, maybe because we need to keep on moving. But what happens to us when we do that? And why in the world would acknowledging small and large traumatic moments lead to growth? My friend lost her young husband suddenly, and many of us think her resilience is remarkable. But one night recently, she cried, and I pulled up in my car next to her, and she said, "You know, I don't cry enough." And I thought, yeah, there's something universal in her plight. We are all equipped with an understandable capacity for distancing traumatic events. But what if we learn to pause, to notice that pain, big or small? What if noticing it is a way to release it? What if doing so makes us more human, caring, and wise, as Dr. Epstein puts it? My returning guest, Dr. Mark Epstein, received his undergraduate and medical degrees from Harvard. He's interested in the interface between Buddhist philosophy and psychotherapy. His book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Glad you're here. So, of course, we will tell you throughout the show that we can send this book to your door to someone you care about. We'll tell you throughout the hour how to do that. The number, just in case you want to jot it down, is 1-800-584-2788. But Mark, when you say everyday trauma, we all know the big things: death, illness, and on it goes, fire, homelessness, hunger. But what are the little things you're talking about?
Well, the little things can be any accident or interruption, anything that doesn't go the way you were expecting it to go in your day. So it can be as small as your 4-year-old child not cooperating with you when you have to get out the door to get to work or to get him or her to school. Mm. It can be as small as your spouse not being considerate the way you expect him or her to be. It can be as small as the subway leaving just as you've come down the stairs, so that's going to make you late. Or it can be a visit to the doctor's office, you know, where they see something but they don't know if it's going to be serious or not, and you're not going to know for the next 4 days. Mm. I mean, the shadow of death and illness and lack of control is basically what I'm calling trauma, and it can hit us in the big ways, or there can be little whispers of it in all these small things.
You're in the profession of measuring pain, talking that through with people. In terms of measuring, why do you call what we consider those little whispers that show how not in control we are of things? Why do you call that trauma? Because most of us associate trauma with huge things.
Well, the reason I call it trauma is because the way the mind reacts to those things is very similar to the way the mind reacts to the big traumas. And I think that's one major thing that we've learned from dealing with the big traumas, you know, from an understanding of post-traumatic stress and so on, which really has emerged in the past generation. There was little understanding of the dynamics of post-traumatic stress, you know, 30 years ago. The mind reacts to trauma by pushing it to one side because it's too much, it's too overwhelming to deal with, and the ego or the self needs to carry on. So to prevent us from fragmenting, you know, in the face of big trauma, we learn how to dissociate, or we instinctively know how to dissociate. We push the traumatic feelings away so that we don't have to deal with them. But what I've discovered from my work as a therapist is that that same mechanism, that same dynamic is what people are using all the time in everyday life to deal with all the little struggles that they're engaged in. So that people are rushing through their lives, trying to be normal, pushing the difficult feelings off to one side, and that creates an uncomfortable split within us.
Yeah, let's get at that. What's the problem with that split? Because we've talked before on the show about how we tend to do some of this to put one foot in front of the other to get through.
And that's very important. Some of that is very adaptive. You know, I'm by no means saying that we should just become a mess, you know. But what I'm saying is that that instinctive thing of pushing the overwhelming feelings away, that does help us get through life. We have a day to get through. We have work to get through. We have a life to get through. But that there's room in the midst of that or around the side of that or maybe, you know, before you go to sleep at night or when you're talking to your friend or when you're taking the dog out for a walk or whatever, or when you're in your therapist's office, there's room to let the feelings in. The dissociative response doesn't have to be the only response.
And what does it cost us by turning away from, pushing down, ignoring these little and big things? What does it cost? What's the benefit to not doing that before we get to how to do it?
The benefit to not doing it, I think, really is that it opens us up empathically to all the other people in the world who are struggling with their everyday and also big traumas. That when we push our own feelings away, it creates a kind of rigidity and closed-mindedness and actually self-centeredness because we're just so focused on getting through our lives that we don't want to see our own suffering and we don't want to see the suffering of anybody else. And that if we let our own in, it humanizes us, and then we can look around and we start to see that other people are human in that way too. And that's a different way of being in the world.
In being that person, because many will turn away from the suffering of others because it's painful on many levels to watch that.
Yeah.
And it's threatening because on some level, consciously or unconsciously, you might get the feeling, this too could happen to me.
Well, in a certain way, it's interesting. We like watching the suffering of others. That's what all the media is about, you know. That's what the news is about. So we turn the TV on and we see it, but we have this sense of it's not us, you know. Mm-hmm. It's happening over there, and we have our own safe world, you know. And it's only when something like Newtown happens or the Hurricane Sandy happens or, you know, we've had our share of big traumas in our country, that worldview starts to crack, you know, and then we're really not prepared. We don't really know how to relate. So I'm saying we can practice with the little things, and that will help us with the big things.
You're saying that if we do practice this, and I'd love to hear, I know from your book, which I adore, I understand how to do that, but I want to have you talk about it some. If we do practice and we become more compassionate, what's the benefit? How is that helpful to the individual person? What is the value of that kind of compassion, maybe beyond identifying with other people in the world?
Well, I think that you can talk about the value of it in a lot of different ways. I have a friend who's a newscaster on one of the WABC news shows, and he started having panic attacks on the air. And although he was not into any of this Buddhist stuff, you know, he found himself drawn to it because he needed something that would help him. And he's come up with a thesis that relating in this way makes you maybe 10%. 10% happier. You know? So, and I think that's very smart of him, you know, like, okay, 10%, because it gives you a little more room to navigate your own emotional terrain, you know, instead of being afraid of yourself, you know, afraid of being overwhelmed, you're actually practicing tolerating, you know, in our field, we call it frustration tolerance, maybe, or we call it anger management, or, you know, or in AA, they talk about, you know, being able to acknowledge your helplessness in the face of alcohol and being able to turn your will over to God or to a higher power. Those are all different ways of talking about what the benefit is.
I would think, Mark, that it also strengthens your ability to see things from another person's point of view. You know, people have arguments all the time in love relationships or in workplaces. And the hardest thing when a button gets pushed is to understand where the other person might be coming from, what it might be like for that other person. You're really just thinking so much about yourself. Is that a fair benefit?
I think it's. I think if it really, would allow us to see from other people's points of view, that would be a wonderful benefit. And I think maybe ideally or occasionally, that actually does happen. But I think that's one of the most difficult things. You know, even working as a therapist, when couples come who you know really love each other, but they're two individual people, and it's super hard to see from another person's perspective. It's, you know, that's really one of the most difficult things to achieve. But I do think that this way of relating to one's own emotional experience that I'm trying to talk about in terms of acknowledging trauma, facing trauma, not running away from it, I do think that eventually for some people it might help a tiny bit. Maybe 5%.
Okay. This is Dr. Mark Epstein, and his book is so wise and useful. And it's called The Trauma of Everyday Life. And it is about how to process the little things and the big things that happen in all of our daily lives, the little whispers, the slights, the pain, and the benefit of just pausing on that. Because to do so, to acknowledge it, to feel it, is to release it, is the way the idea goes. When we had Mark on the show talking about this book the last time, the response was unbelievable. And so we asked him to come back and talk more about this. The Trauma of Everyday Life by psychiatrist in New York, Mark Epstein. And we pause now. We're going to continue our conversation with Mark. We're pausing just a moment to say this is our thank you gift to you, this book, for supporting this show and everything you hear on WNPR. The number is 1-800-584-2788. Jack Callahan.
Hello, Faith. I'm listening along today and enjoying this conversation very much, and reminder that we will be going right back to it. But we are taking these moments to ask for support for the Faith Middleton Show for conversations just like this. And we ask you to call 1-800-584-2788 or go online at WNPR.org to make your contribution. That way it's safe and secure. As our way of saying thank you, we'd love to send you this book, The Trauma of Everyday Life, for a contribution of $8 a month when you become a monthly donor, or a one-time contribution of $96. This is an amazing book. I have a copy here, and I've been kind of peeking in and around as I've been listening, and we'd love to get this to you. Again, that number to call is 1-800-584-2788. That's how you support WNPR, support the Faith Middleton Show, support conversations, engaging communication just like this.
I wanted to say that Mark is going to talk about something called realistic view. You know, we're all counseled that trauma in any form is some kind of failure or a mistake. And if we're not counseled that way, we get the sense that that's true. But he points out it is not something to be ashamed of, not a sign of weakness. It's not a reflection of inner failing. It is simply trauma, a fact of life. It goes on in all of our lives all the time, in little ways and in very big ways. So this is such a wonderful look. And also a look at why Buddhist philosophy, I don't mean that in a religious sense, but why Buddhist philosophy has something wise to contribute to daily living. And so here's a psychiatrist who's interested in looking at those two things coming together in his therapy. 1-800-584-2788. If you can join us for $8 a month, so appreciated, or a one-time contribution of $96. We are here because of your supporting gifts. And so please call us now, 1-800-584-2788, or go online to WNPR.org. Fill out that little form, and we're off and running.
Yeah, we made it as fast and easy as possible. We'll ask for your name, address, method of payment, enroll you as a monthly donor if you would like, or that one-time contribution. And if you would like that thank you gift of the book, The Trauma of Everyday Life, you let us know, and you'll be on your way back ready to listen to more of the program, but having done something very important for WNPR and for your community, keeping this type of journalism, keeping this type of conversation alive. The Faith Middleton Show, exploring the richness of life, but it's all aspects of life, many aspects of life, including today's faith. I was caught up by that comment about the little whispers. I think of trauma as ambulance screaming and heading to an emergency room or emotional trauma from some major tragedy. And Lord knows we have certainly had our share of these in our own area in the last year or so. But the little whispers of life, it put it in a different perspective. And I love the idea of practicing on those little whispers of life so that you are prepared for those larger ones. And it's given me a different way to think, as so often happens when I listen to the Faith Middleton Show here. If you believe this, and you support this, you show your support by calling 1-800-584-2788. We're eager to get your name on a list to receive The Trauma of Everyday Life.
You know, one of the things that I do here on the show and have done for a long time is to curate. And I do that with my great colleagues, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. So what I'm doing here is finding people and the things they create that I hope will enlarge your life, your sense of self, make you more expansive as it makes me. And it is such a privilege and a pleasure to do this work. And I find that in my guest and in his book, The Trauma of Everyday Life by Dr. Mark Epstein. If you would like to contribute $8 a month, we thank you. That is a $96 one-time gift to the station. This is what keeps us going, enables us to bring you these shows as we do every day. Also, Where We Live, the Colin McEnroe Show. So three different local productions going on here. $8 a month, $96 one time, 1-800-584-2788. And thanks. I'm Faith Middleton. It's great to have you listening. As you know, or if you're just joining us, The Trauma of Everyday Life is a book, and the author is Dr. Mark Epstein. He's a practicing psychiatrist in New York City. He has counseled countless people about little traumas and big traumas, and he has become, as a result, interested in the intersection between Buddhist philosophy, not as a religion, but the philosophy of Buddhism and what it might offer in this way, and helping us to understand trauma and how unpredictable daily life is, whether it's the little things or the very big things. And Mark received his medical degrees, all of them at Harvard. Yale. So, Mark, I want to know why we would want to concentrate on, you know, a million things happen in a day. And so you could actually be feeling, you know, little slights and, you know, reacting to people's tones of voice.
I could. I can feel that all the time.
Yeah, I could too. And so why do we want to concentrate on that? I'm trying to get at how you explain the benefit of doing so.
Well, maybe I can come around from another side and tell you a little story. I had a conversation last year with my 88-year-old mother. After my father had died maybe 3 or 4 years before, and my mother was talking to me about how, you know, it's been 3 or 4 years, it must be 4 years since my father, her husband, died, and she felt like she really ought to be over it by now. And that's my mother, you know, it's like sort of practical. She really ought to be over it by now. And I, as her psychiatrist son, you know, was like, really? You think you should be over it by now? You think trauma, the trauma of that sort, has to have a fixed ending, and you should be able to be back to normal? Because I had just finished writing the book, you know, so these kinds of thoughts were in my head. And I realized that so many people in our culture now have this idea from the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that, you know, in dealing with a trauma like the death of a loved one, that we're supposed to go through these five stages of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, and then come out the other side and be ourselves again. And my mother was kind of a victim of this way of thinking. And I counseled her, you know, like, really? Why not give yourself a little room to actually feel what you're feeling? You know, like, you're still upset, of course. And then she said, well, yes, maybe you're right. You know, when my first husband died, it took about 10 years before I felt myself again. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, except I never knew she had a first husband until I was like 15 or so, and I discovered by chance. And, you know, my father had never wanted to deal with my mother's trauma from the sudden death of her first husband. And so she had to do the usual thing of pushing it to one side. And then when my father died, the trauma of the earlier death surfaced in her. And and there was an opportunity then to deal with the feelings that she had never dealt with. So my point is that all these traumas are happening, you know, big and little. And if we can learn how to make room for the way they're impacting us as they're happening, that we don't end up in my mother's position at the end of her life, you know, feeling like she shouldn't be feeling what she's feeling.
Yeah, you know? that she'd failed somehow.
Yeah, that she'd failed somehow or was failing. Was continuing to fail.
You write in the book, I'm just looking at this sentence, when I read it the first time, I had underlined it. The clear-eyed comprehension of suffering permits its release.
Yeah.
Why is that so?
Well, that's the basic discovery of the Buddha's psychology. That's where that sentence is coming from. The Buddha was all about staring reality in the face. You know, that was his big contribution as I think of him as the world's first great psychoanalyst, you know. Even before Freud, the Buddha did a self-analysis, and he spent 5 years trying to get away from his own inner turmoil and inner pain by using the various forms of meditation and self-hypnosis that were already established in India. And then he had a whole turnaround where he realized trying to get away from the pain was just reinforcing it in some way. You know, and that instead of trying to get away from it so much, he should learn how to just be with it. And that's where the Buddhist form of meditation originated, that learning how to be with the pain, you know, this idea that pain is not pathology, that the mind is capable, the mind has its own endogenous endorphins, you know, that if you learn how to allow the pain to pass through you, it will be metabolized, and you can survive it. That's where the Buddhist psychology is coming from, and that turns out to actually be true as far as the contemporary neuroscience and so on has affirmed much of these early Buddhist insights.
There's a phrase in French that I'm about to slaughter called esprit d'escalier, you know, the staircase wit, and it refers to the comeback that instantly comes to you, the clever thing to say, the right thing to say. And the reason I mention it is the difficulty is knowing when the small thing or the big thing has burrowed into you. You know, some things are obvious. Somebody snaps at you, you know. But, you know, there are all these other things that happen where you just don't realize it till later, if at all, consciously. How do we do this? How do we make ourselves aware? And then how do we feel it, and so that it permits its release?
Well, the model that I use in the book comes from what we know about the way mothers instinctively relate to their babies. That anyone who has been around a small infant or has had a child or was once a child themselves knows how difficult it is, how ruthless a baby's need and aggression can be. You know, a baby is a lot to handle. But a mother, without having had a lot of instruction, you know, because of her instinctive feel for the baby, manages all of that difficult emotion, manages the baby's attacks on her, the baby's need for her. She intuitively knows. And what I'm saying, and what I think the Buddha was saying a long, long time ago, was that inherent capacity to manage difficult emotion is there in all of us. We learned it when we were babies from our parents, and we have that capacity within ourselves to handle even the most difficult things that happen to us. You know, we're afraid of it. We're afraid of our anxiety. We're afraid of our grief. We're afraid of our anger. But if we learn how to hold it in an analogous way to how a mother intuitively holds her baby, then it becomes much more tolerable, and we don't have to be so afraid.
I think at times the fear that I have felt, consciously and unconsciously, that if I experience it, it will never stop.
Yes. And often that actually, if you can allow yourself to go to the place of, okay, maybe it will never stop, that sometimes it takes that level of acceptance to allow the thing to stop.
It's brave.
It requires either a lot of practice or a lot of courage, or both.
And this idea of holding the baby and experiencing the feeling, it's one thing to say, you know, I am intellectually, I am whatever right now. I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm whatever. But how do you mean feel it? I get the image is beautiful of the mother consoling the child.
Yeah. How do I mean feel it? What most people do is they feel it only for a tiny second, and then their mind kicks in and they start telling themselves stories about what a terrible person they are to have ended up in this situation, you know, or to have this kind of feeling. So when I say feel it, I often mean let's come back out of those thoughts, which are really just like worst case scenario thoughts, you know, of you telling yourself that you're such a bad person. Let's come back to the actual feeling that you're running away from, you know, and spend a little more time, you know, okay, of course you're sad. Your boyfriend isn't calling you back. You know, of course you're sad. That's a really hard thing to tolerate, you know, but it doesn't mean that you're a terrible person. It doesn't mean that you're never going to have another boyfriend. It doesn't mean that the way you said goodbye was like completely the wrong thing. You know, those, if you just come back to the feeling of, ugh, what is it? You know, how bad does it feel to be rejected by somebody? Eventually, your mind is going to recover from that feeling.
How do you practice this on your own? You know, it's one thing that what you just described is a terrific thing in therapy. And, you know, in the hands of a good therapist, that's what it's like, what you just described. But you're on your own and the day is speeding along. How do we pause to register what has happened?
Well, it turns out it's actually not even necessary to pause, that you can do it while you're in motion. It's really about asking yourself those kinds of questions that I was just proposing. You know, like when you can see that the mind likes to take over and tell you stories about, you know, how ashamed you should feel or how bad you are or how wrong this is to be feeling what you're feeling. Once you can recognize, even while you're moving around, that those thoughts are taking you down the wrong path, then you can deliberately just bring yourself back to, okay, I'm feeling bad. But the bad feeling doesn't have to be running me around. It doesn't have to make me go to the corner grocery store and buy a bag of candy and eat it. It doesn't have to make me go to the bar and drink three shots of liquor. You know, it doesn't have to send me down some kind of self-destructive path. I could, while I'm walking, while I'm taking the dog out, while I'm picking up the kids, I could be making room for what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And I could learn to breathe in and out of the feeling. You know, there are all kinds of tricks that become cliches, but that can be helpful.
And you do talk about them in the book. This is Dr. Mark Epstein, practicing psychiatrist in New York City, returning to our show. So many people responded to the first conversation. We've had him back. His book is called The Trauma of Everyday Life. Mark, please stay there because I want to talk about resilience. I want to talk about Newtown. The Trauma of Everyday Life, we would be delighted to send this book to you or to someone you care about if you think it would be helpful. To me, it's helpful in my life and any life, but 1-800-584-2788. It's our thank you gift. If you can make an $8 per month gift to the station to keep us on the air, or a $96 one-time contribution. And thank you in advance. 1-800-584-2788.
And let me explain a little bit more about how this monthly donor program works, Faith. We've been talking about this a little bit here, and it's a very simple process. We've had our listeners and our members asking us, I don't want to worry about my membership lapsing. And when did I last make a contribution? So we've set this plan in place at members' request, and it's been very successful and very helpful for us in our budget planning here. What we'll do is take $8 a month out of your charge card or your bank account if you choose the EFT option. We offer either, and this is on an ongoing basis. So you'll become an ongoing member here, an ongoing supporter of the Faith Middleton Show. And of course, when you make that call today and become an $8 a month or more member, then we'll be happy to add your name to the list to receive The Trauma of Everyday Life. This is an ongoing membership. It stays in place until we hear from you that you must make a change in your plan. It's a win-win. It helps you budget throughout the year. Above all, though, it helps you support programs. It helps you support conversations like the one you're having. Faith, you mentioned that you were a curator. I think of you sometimes as the marinator on Food Schmooze days, but I love that phrase of the curator here. And you engage with authors, artists and historians, journalists, and sometimes political analysts. But today, this conversation, one that you don't hear on the other dial, one that you don't devote a full hour to, this is what WNPR does. This is what Faith Middleton does, and she does it because of member support. 1-800-584-2788 is the number to call to become one of these very special supporters.
There is something in this book that I think, without using the word so much, addresses resilience. I don't mean, and we're going to get into this conversation, I don't mean that I think everybody can recover from anything. But it is handy to build that resilience muscle. And I think what Mark has done here helps with that. And it's one of the things I find so valuable about what he does in general and what he's done in this book. We work like crazy, day and night, all of us on our shows, to get you the best people we can. And it is, again, a pleasure and a privilege to do that. I'm so glad that the public radio exists, and we are so honored to be your public radio station. So whether you visit us online where you can contribute and have this book sent to you, WNPR.org, or you phone in, or just sit and listen from wherever you are, thank you, thank you for that. 1-800-584-2788. There is nothing like that connection. That's why I love to do what I do.
The number to call again is 1-800-584-2788, or go online at WNPR.org and find the red donate button. We've made it as simple as possible. We are going back to more of this conversation in just a moment, but we take these minutes, these precious minutes for WNPR, to ask for your help. That's because listener support is the largest single source of support that WNPR has. To pay its dues, its fair share to NPR for the programs like Morning Edition, All Things Considered. But importantly right now, the local programs, the Faith Middleton Show, the Colin McEnroe Show, Where We Live. listening right now to the Faith Middleton Show and asking for your help right now to keep us on track with the budget so we can continue to do more of what we do, what you've been listening to. That's a pretty good deal, I think, if you think about it for just a moment. Go to that phone, make that $8 a month contribution or a one-time gift of $96 to make sure your name is on the list to receive a copy of this book.
And thank you so much as we go back to our conversation with Dr. Mark Epstein. I'm Faith Middleton, and my guest, New York City practicing psychiatrist Dr. Mark Epstein, author of this book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. It is about the little things and the big things, and how little suffering from this unpredictable life of ours every day, or the giant suffering, how does that get released? It gets released by acknowledging its presence and feeling it, and Mark talks all about that in his book. So, Mark, here's a story, because I think before we get to Newtown, I want to talk about how we can be clueless that we're suffering from something, not even understand what it is. I was thinking about my sister losing her first husband at 42. She's my best friend. And so it was a shock because he died at 42 of a heart attack. And I remember it was just before Christmas, and so I ran out and I just bought her all kinds of presents to open on Christmas Eve. And on Christmas morning, I just didn't plan ahead, and there was really nothing for her to open because I'd given her everything the night before, and I just didn't know. I didn't think. So I think I'm saying this, I really didn't like Christmas for a long time. And I didn't stop and say, you know, you're in pain about this. It wasn't until I was in a therapist's office explaining it, the therapist said, oh my goodness, let's look at that. Let's deal with that. And you know what? Talking about that did permit its release. And I started to love Christmas again.
Yeah, that's nice.
So this idea of being clueless, can you address that where you just don't know what the source is?
I think that question goes back to what I was talking about earlier about the usual response to anything traumatic, big or little, is to dissociate from the pain which feels unbearable. And when we dissociate, we push whatever it is that we're feeling, we push it into an unaware place, you know, which we sometimes call the unconscious, you know. And when it gets put in that unaware place, whatever that is, however that works, then we are clueless, you know. And then it's operating but on us, but it's operating subliminally, so that maybe when we dream, there's a clue about it, or maybe something comes along, like Christmas in your case comes along, and you have a reaction to it that is kind of inexplicable until you put the pieces together and realize, oh yeah, maybe that explains it. So people, that's one of the great gifts of therapy, is you get to see how, oh yeah, this is part of the puzzle that makes people up, you know, mm-hmm. that they're at least some portion of their experience is being run by their unconscious.
Yeah, and it seems, as you talk in the book, that certain kinds of, well, I guess any kind of trauma, it seems as if it's registered in a certain part of the brain, and we do hang on to it.
Yeah, it's registered. It's from the brain studies and so on. It seems like it's registered in a part of the brain where it kind of enters without language. It's in a deeper part of the brain that's connected to the emotional centers, and it goes straight in, the way when you're a kid and you're learning how to ride a bicycle, or you're learning how to like play with other kids. There's a kind of learning that takes place that isn't processed through the thinking mind. It goes straight in, like it's how we relate. trauma goes in that way, and then it gets stuck in a certain way. One of the great neurobiologists of trauma has a line where he says, "Emotional memory may be forever." You know, so that those the substrate of the emotion is it's in there somehow, and then it gets triggered in ways that we can't control, and that's the scary thing about trauma. You know, that it's going to surface at some point and fill us with that unbearable feeling again.
Mm. Of course, this makes me think so much of citizens of Newtown and then. Citizens of anywhere, USA, who have experienced, you know, some kind of similar horror.
Yeah.
I remember a man calling and saying that he'd lost his children on Christmas Eve, and the only thing he could think to do was start a scholarship in their names.
Yeah.
And so I wonder about re-experiencing trauma from this anniversary in Newtown that we're all in the media going to be talking about. I wonder about whether there is enough focus on resilience. That is a topic that I am going to be addressing on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And trying so hard not to pressure people in Newtown to feel resilient if they don't. So can you say something about this?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not sure that the media celebrating, or that's probably not the right word, but the media mm-hmm. Playing to the anniversary is necessarily a therapeutic mm-hmm. thing for the people who actually suffered mm-hmm. from the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's unfortunately, you know, I'm sure it's all well intentioned in the media and so on,
mm-hmm.
but unfortunately, I think that goes more to what I was saying before, that we like to create spectacle out of trauma, out of these tragedies, but that is some kind of cultural way that we have of, again, dissociating from the actual pain. You know, we mm-hmm. look at it on television and we talk about it as if, you know, we're doing our best to honor it. But for the people who actually were traumatized, I think they may experience a lot of that media stuff as a kind of re-traumatization. What people who were touched by the tragedy actually need is a kind of safe space to begin to feel their own horror and their own shock and their own loss and their own pain and to rediscover the love that they had for those kids, you know, who were brutally taken away from them, to make a connection back to who they were before the tragedy. You know, so that their lives aren't irrevocably split down the middle by it. I think that's where the healing comes from. And I'm not sure that is anything mm-hmm. that the media can do for people. People have to find ways of allowing that to happen for themselves.
What can the media do? The media is designed to ask lots of questions on anniversaries. We've seen a report released on what have finally an official report released and everybody yelling about holes in the report. We saw this with 9/11 and the erection of the building and the memorial, people fighting.
Yeah.
If you were designing something, what would be helpful? I would love to know that, you know, to all. What would be helpful?
I think it's rare that someone within the media comes up with an approach that actually is helpful. I don't think it's unheard of. And I think that we all kind of recognize it when it happens. I think part of the outcry, you know, a couple of years ago on the Today Show when they had all the political stuff going on with the various hosts losing their jobs and so on. I mm-hmm. think that, you know, sometimes one of those news anchors, she was able to do a story that actually pulled people in and made them mm-hmm. feel intricate spectacle, but made it something that could be shared. But I think that's really hard to do. I don't know how to do it, and I wouldn't be the one to be giving advice about it.
Yeah. You had a connection to the woman who wrote the book Wave. Her whole family swept away in the tsunami. That is major trauma. You know, that's Newtown-scale trauma. So how do you work with someone who's been through something like that?
Well, she was a very brave and beautiful woman who somehow found her way to me. And many of your listeners won't know the book, but she wrote a beautiful book that people can be scared to look at because there's so much loss there. But it's really a book about love. I didn't work with her in any way that was any different from how I work with anybody else. I just asked her really about her children when she first came to me, because in my office, when it's just me sitting there with someone, it doesn't really matter if the people that we're talking about are alive or dead. You know, they're still alive in the mind of the person that I'm talking to. So I just had her talk to me about her kids, which was the most important thing at that moment. And from there, we gradually just talked about, whatever came up, everything. And she ended up writing a lot of it in the book, which is a beautiful book.
Yeah. Mark, thank you so much for returning to the show. Thank you for writing this book and the kind of work you do. I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
You're very welcome, of course.
Dr. Mark Epstein, practicing psychiatrist in New York City, and he has written this book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. And the idea is to acknowledge any kind of suffering, small or large, is to permit its release. And this is a book about how, why, and we would be so happy to send this to you or to someone you care about. If you can make an $8 per month contribution, we've had Mark back on the show because there's been so much response to our first conversation about this book. That's a one-time contribution of $96. Here's the toll-free number, 1-800-584-2788.
And we'll be going on to another program in just a moment, but there's still time for you to register your support by making that call at 1-800-584-2788, or you can go online at WNPR.org. I'm Jack Callahan, listening along with you. My job is to head up the membership program here at WNPR to see that we have the dollars from the community, from the listeners, to make sure that we keep programs like the Faith Middleton Show on the air. It's that simple, and it works so well when listeners just like you take the time to make the important call or that online contribution to keep it coming. Again, the number is 1-800-584-2788. For an $8 a month contribution, when you become a monthly donor here, we'll get your name on the list to receive a copy of this book as our way of saying thank you. It is my job to ask for your support. It's always my privilege to say thank you when you do. Won't you be the next person that we can thank by calling 1-800-584-2788?
I guess I leave it to you to decide about phoning in, because it's not a thing that anyone has to do. All I can tell you is that we work so hard to try to bring you what you tell us you want, to focus on the richness of life in all its magnificence and challenge. I think that's what public radio does. It's not about advertising dollars. And so we turn to you a few times a year and say, look, if we all pitch in, we can keep this amazing thing going. We are here because of your supporting gifts. And so please call us now, 1-800-584-2788, or go online to WNPR.org. Fill out that little form and we're off and running.
Yeah, we made it as fast and easy as possible. We'll ask for your name, address, method of payment, enroll you as a monthly donor if you would like, or that one-time contribution. This book is more than 200 pages, and it's a hardcover book. It has a really nice jacket. I'm sitting here looking at this, and filled with information. You know, Faith, I was struck by the comment, too, that we were in your conversation, but the on-air person on the television who said the story didn't make a spectacle but was wanting to share. We don't look for shock value. We don't look for spectacles. We want to share. That doesn't mean we don't dodge the hard questions. We don't raise debate. But all debate, all different points of view coming out are done in a manner that is with dignity and respect, even though there's a lot of passion behind those. That's part of the value that we stand on. And it's made possible. This exception to much of the news and what's on the other radio stations is made possible by listeners. Won't you become part of the solution to keep WNPR financially strong, to keep the Faith Middleton Show right here where it belongs by calling 1-800-584-2788 or going online at WNPR.org.
We are going back to the other kind of programming, taking a quick break here. We just wanted to offer you what we could, to offer you an example of a voice that we think is important in the world, a book that is valuable and important in the world. And we'd love to send it as our thank you gift to you. $8 a month or a one-time gift of $96 to keep everything you hear at WNPR on the air. 1-800-584-2788. And thank you so much.